So there's let me just go right here. I mean, there's so much we didn't get into in our inaugural episode, but what we did get instantly attracted people to your knowledge and intellect. If only the audience knew that we barely got a quarter of the topics and questions we originally had for you. And for those of you who are new to this podcast, welcome. This is Colonial Outcast. We are an anti-war, anti-imperialist, pro-Palestinian, pro-Jewish, and anti-Zionist podcast conceived by former Army Ranger Sergeant Greg Stoker, who is not with us today, but is heavily invested in this particular episode, and myself, to offer more bridging, maybe even military approach to the pro-Palestinian movement for those who are either square one on the Palestinian suffering to the decades-long activist and everyone in between. Doc was our first guest for our maiden episode, and ever since, that episode has had a huge impact on the conversation as it added a lot of nuance and historical insight. He has his own YouTube channel called After Hours with the Mad Professor, which I highly recommend if you are searching for a new addiction. Because
just to pardon me, office hours.
What did I say?
After hours. Which is a whole different vibe. I mean, if I was going for like the nightclub vibe, you know, like, ooh, you know.
did I really say after hour? Maybe that's what's on my mind right now. I don't know. It's okay. It's office hours with my professor, which I highly recommend if you're searching for a new addiction. And this addiction comes with the side effect of gaining a lot of nuanced knowledge and on the most interesting topics from a historian who makes it digestible. Dr. Omara hosts TikTok Lives, where curious, beautiful minds like the ones in our audience. Doc is definitely a decades-long activist and fully invested intellectually on this topic through his role as an educator. And being an anti-statist libertarian as myself, it's nice to engage with a fellow anarchist, to be quite honest. That's my little selfish enjoyment that I get from talking with you. And it also gives me a lot of confirmation bias for my anarchy. So we recently did a podcast with a stand-up comic and pro-Palestinian activist. He hosts a podcast called the Palestine Pod, I believe it is, where we talked about the destructive and anti-Semitic nature of Zionism. It was definitely more of a colorful conversation about it and not as academic as usual, but still very important. That's why I think this episode is so fitting as our next one, because this is the one where I want us to get deep into the weeds of Zionism and deep into the weeds of anti-Semitism. I also want to talk about Islamophobic conspiracy theories and why that they typically come from the same kinds of people as anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. So that's very important to talk about. So Doc, missed you a whole lot. The audience has missed you a whole lot. It was one of our most watched episodes. They were so enthralled with your knowledge for people who they know a lot of things, but to gain like very intricate, nuanced details of the arguments that they've been involved with, your episode gave them that ammunition to deal with, the intellectual ammunition, you know? So, Doc, how you been?
Doing all right, actually. Keeping busy. There's always a ton of projects I'm supposed to be working on all at once. So I, but I, you know, keep on moving along.
So, yeah.
I'm not sure what else to say other than that, but it does get me out of trouble.
That's good. Yeah. This has kept me out of trouble for the most part, I think, you know, yeah. Right? Or it's got me in trouble. I don't know. It's one of those two.
Yeah, definitely one of the, I mean, granted, if your activism gets you in trouble, you're probably doing something right.
That's usually the case historically.
Yep. Well-behaved people do not make history.
No, they don't. They don't. Yep. Well, Doc, let's get into the weeds of Zionism for a second, if we may.
Sure.
You've talked on this subject to an excruciating extent on your own YouTube channel. I guess this would be for more of those people who haven't been exposed to you and your intricate breakdown of Zionism. And I know it's a long and hairy topic, but, and I know there's only so much time we get to have with you, but let's just get into it. Let's dive into its origins, its role in all this, its relationship with anti-Semitism. A lot of stuff to cover. So I'm just gonna let you take it from here.
Oh, well, all right. I guess the first thing that anyone really should know if they're diving into a topic like this, especially given that we tend to be very reductive in a lot of common discourse, Zionism actually has a whole lot of different meanings depending on the context. There is... What? My dog is saying hello. What?
I'm going to introduce you to my dog soon. Or I already did. I want to see how much she's grown.
There's an element of Zionism that is actually baked into Judaism. And when I point things like this out to people, sometimes it takes them directly to, oh, well, if you think that Judaism is inherently settler colonial or whatever, then I'm like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it depends again on how you want to use the word. Because at its core, what it's about is ending an exile and returning to a land of origin for the people. Because Jewish cultural identity, Jewish ethnic identity is rooted in the Levant. They have the same basic origins as the Palestinian peoples, but the peoples who stayed behind and became Palestinians are those Canaanites, Samaritans, Jews, and others there that slowly just adopted Christianity and then for some of them Islam. The population spread around. People, because of a number of different disasters, tons of Jews had fled the land in various waves, really speeding up in the first and second centuries of the Common Era in the wake of unsuccessful revolts. And there's always a sense that they should return someday. Now, that can mean just returning and mixing in with everybody else that's there, or it can mean wait for the Messiah to come and put the whole world right and then go back. So there's a kind of traditional Zionism that has a sort of messianic component to it. But not all Jews who have returned, and Jews have actually returned in waves over many centuries, long before the rise of modern Zionism. So a lot of the Jews that were expelled in 1492 from Spain, some of them ended up in Palestine. You know, some of them are in the community of Tzfat in northern Israel, the Safed. way back when. There's also a wave that comes in the 18th century. All this is before the rise of what we call Zionism, just Zionism. But there's, again, a sense in which wanting to go home is part and parcel of Judaism as a religion of exile, a community of exile. Right. The modern secular nationalist form of Zionism is distinctly different. And it's usually what people mean by it. But before you even get to that, it's probably worth understanding that there is a significant Christian variant of it that actually predates also the modern rise of secular Zionism. And that has its origins in what was called at the time Restorationism. And it comes about through the Protestant Reformation. Because from very early on, the Catholic and Orthodox traditions turn viciously against Jews. And when you want to talk about like the origins of anti-Semitism later, we have to go back to Christianity to deal with some of that stuff. But there's a move there that suggested within Catholic and Orthodox theology that Jews had been cast out by God. They were no longer the chosen people. They were no longer Israel. That was now the church. And the Jews, were abandoned by God because of their sins. And the Protestants reversed that, because that's not in the Bible. Like much of Catholic belief, it's not present in the scripture itself. And when you get down to sola scriptura, you're reading the book. Hey, if it's not in the book, there's a problem here. And anybody reading the Christian Old Testament is like, huh, God gave this land to Jews. Shit, I guess we should let Jews live there. So they started encouraging a movement there. So that became an element within Protestantism in general. And it accelerated in the 19th century alongside the development of some distinctly apocalyptic trends in Christianity. There's been various waves of millenarian thought in Christianity all along, but it rises and falls and it takes different forms. Anybody who's heard about people looking forward to the rapture, for example, that idea only comes into existence in the 19th century. It's a new interpretation. There's a lot of thought, in there looking forward. Where is the real end of the world? Where is, and how you're trying to reinterpret prophecy and figure out where it is. And one of those,
that's the camp that I fell victim to. So I come from that camp, the one that you just mentioned,
the apocalyptic ones,
the apocalyptic evangelical. Yeah. So I come from that. I came from that original, good old fashioned American Zionism that is indoctrinated in the Bible Belt and beyond, you know?
It's a significant part of American evangelical Protestantism, but also exists in Europe. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a lot of the British Christian Zionists had the same basic view. The argument there is that for the end of the world to happen, a Jewish temple state needs to exist, because that's how it's described in the Bible. There's a temple, but there's no temple anymore. So Jews should go back, create a new temple state, build a new temple, have a priesthood, all the rest of that stuff. Then an apocalyptic war can break out and most Jews will die, and there's that. So it's really a kind of anti-Semitic Zionism. But
it is
because it's calling for essentially the death of nearly all Jews directly, and then the conversion of the remainder of them to Christianity. So essentially a complete end to Judaism. That is developing technically before the rise of Jewish Zionism. You know, it builds up slowly through various theological trends in the late 18th and early 19th century, and then really comes into its own across the course of the 19th century. Secular Zionism is fundamentally different from all of these because it's not tied in any way to the religious culture. You know, it's not tied to Christianity or to Judaism as faiths. It's tied to the ethnic understanding. And Judaism is both an ethnic group and a religious group. It's a tribal religion. So it has a peoplehood dimension that's always been present in it. You join the tribe. If you become Jewish, you're born into the tribe. There's an ethnic identity that's completely separate from whatever you believe. So a Buddhist Jew is still a Jew. You don't lose that Jewish identity unless you consciously choose to reject it somehow. Because it's a kind of like a tribal identity, a distinct cultural identity. And that's what it's founded out of. And what they do is they take those ethnic aspects of it and they flesh it out, expand it, and build on it as a way of building a modern national movement. And this has its origins in the development of secular nationalism, which people tend, one of the worst things about social media in general is that if you're not careful, it can really inspire some misanthropy. Like, what is wrong with people? Because you get all the time people arguing with just basic facts. Like, hey, the world is flat. Did you know the world's flat? Like, crap like that. And I've got, you get people all the time telling you that nationalists are people who just really, really love their country. Like, no, bro, that's patriotism. Because nations and countries are completely different things. Nationalism is not about countries. Nationalist movements are often against countries. It's a whole separate issue. Nations are groups of people with something in common. And because it's a social category, not a physical one, it can vary depending on what features you choose to include, which is why we have stupid shit like white nationalism and Christian nationalism and crap like that. You know, what you choose to make the core component of that identity, that's it. Because nations are peoples with something in common. And a national movement there is trying to argue that power, like state power, political power, belongs in the hands of national groups for their purposes. So a state should exist just for this people. And that really is a fundamentally new idea that's only taking off with the Enlightenment. And the French Revolution is arguably the first place that you actually see secular nationalism in play. And it's in that way, France transforms from being a state, which it's been since the 5th century, to the first nation state during the French Revolution. But across the 19th century, nationalism just spreads everywhere in Europe. The French Revolutionary Wars have them fighting all over the place, and their ideas start spreading around. And, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of people tended to think that it was a good alternative to some of the traditional identities that they had, where people have been fighting and killing each other in large numbers for different religious reasons for a long time. You know, maybe we wouldn't do that anymore. Maybe we could live in the same country and have different religions, but we all have the same, like, I don't know, overall national identity, things like that. People thought it might be a good idea, so it seemed very progressive to a lot of people. It ends up being deeply problematic and the most violent political ideology in our history, but different issue. Either way, it made sense in the 19th century to people based upon the long history of religious and cultural conflicts in Europe, political conflicts in Europe, to try and find some new organization. And as nationalism is spreading across Europe and people are adopting the new national identity, Jews were always excluded from it. Even places that tried to give them citizenship, which spread slowly across the 19th century from Napoleon in 1803. By the time you get to the end of the 19th century, it's all the way across Eastern Europe. Everyone's slowly giving them citizenship. But citizenship in the state and membership of the nation are different things. Because again, nations are groups of people, and people define those groupings themselves, you know, not the government. Yeah. So when Jews like, oh, cool, I'm a citizen now, right on. Maybe I'm going to shave my beard. I'm going to move into the city. I'm going to learn to speak Polish or French or whatever and just blend in with people. And then they found out you had a lot of that xenophobic, ah, shit, there goes the neighborhood kind of attitude. Oh, a Jew moved in next door. And people were freaking out. So the assimilationist arguments struggled. There was a significant movement saying, hey, bro, we should just like blend in. We should become part of these other countries. You know, they'll accept us now. It doesn't matter. You know, we can be part of the nation and still, you know, be Jewish. And reality kind of flew in the face of that for a lot of people. So Zionism developed as a nationalist movement. If you won't accept us, then we need some kind of alternative for ourselves. So when people talk about the existence of the state of Israel, for example, it is actually completely reasonable in the sense of 19th century nationalisms. If we take for granted that world, then some state there could exist. But the problem here is that nationalism itself is the problem, which is what caused Jews to flee in the first place. If not for the development of all these different competing national movements in, Poland, Serbia, Germany, wherever the hell you are, these nationalisms that excluded Jews, then Jews wouldn't have felt the need to go off and do their own thing and create their own nation state. But that's what secular nationalism does. Those early forms of secular nationalism, they're a lot more diverse than people tend to give them credit for, too, because there are significant elements of that were led by leftists. So there are a lot of socialist and communist Zionists who wanted to integrate with the Palestinians, organize them as well, build some kind of shared binational future based on class consciousness and all the rest of that. And there's a lot of even liberal trends that were saying, hey, let's go for some kind of binationality. This can be a Jewish state, but also for Palestinians. And we'll come up with some kind of new thing here that basically just breaks away from the old empires. Because again, nationalism is always opposed to giant, the big multinational, like, you know, cosmopolitan empires. It's calling for smaller countries around specific groups of people, right? And at the end of the day, trying to find a way to make Jews, Muslims, and Christians of Levantine origin all kind of work together as a single nation makes a lot more sense than, say, make a giant empire of all kinds of different people, right? So they're thinking, well, we'll create some kind of binational structure here and we'll do that. They end up losing. And it's largely because of the dynamics of the conflict, because of Zionist settler colonialism and growing resistance to that. It feeds a steady radicalization that leads to a kind of hardcore racist ethno-nationalism, pushing all those trends to the side. So they, while they're still significant in the teens, 20s, into the 30s, across the 1930s and 40s, they get marginalized. And those voices have remained marginal ever since. There's always been Zionists who also want a Palestinian state on the same land, that they want some kind of shared democratic state. There's always been Zionists doing that. So when people say all Zionists are bad, they're kind of missing the fact that some of them wanted it to be Palestine, and many of them still do. But the dominant trend has been an exclusivist ethno-national one. And it's only gotten worse, especially since the 67 war, when there's a kind of messianic fervor among a lot of the traditional Jews there that created religious Zionism that now says, well, we got to settle all this land and chase out all the people, because if we give up one little inch of this thing, then we're basically telling God we don't want the Messiah after all.
That would explain the sheer psychotic nature of these settlers that we see on these video clips. Like we've seen the most extreme, probably not actually the most extreme. We're probably barely scratching the surface, but you will see settlers who, you know, will straight up start cussing out somebody who's not Jewish and be like, you know, fuck you, this land belongs to us, God promised this to us. And we go back to that video footage of Ben Gavir celebrating with a bunch of settlers holding up the picture of a baby. And a lot of people didn't know the context of that video, but the context is very horrifying. The picture of that baby was actually a Palestinian baby that they were celebrating having murdered recently. And it was the celebration. It was like a symbol for them. Yeah. This is us getting rid of the disease, you know, a very familiar trope that we've seen throughout history. And it was just eye-opening to see that. And we see these extreme natures of these settlers. And given the context that you're speaking on, it explains where you can get such psychosis, such extremism, such fanaticism.
Yeah. There's a way in which you can see the, there are some structural dimensions that are laid down relatively early on in the 20th century that that accurately predict this getting more and more radical and intractable. Because what happened, like in the first waves of settlement, you know, people, they worked together, they found, you know, ways to collaborate, you know, and integrate in different ways. But, you know, beginning in the aughts, in like the first decade of the 20th century, there's an ideological shift that's pushed by some of the big Zionist organizations that called for completely parallel societies, like separating from the Palestinians, so that you don't integrate with them anymore, you don't interact with them, you're going to buy, even if it costs more money, I'm going to buy only from a Jewish-owned business instead of a Palestinian-owned business because I, you know, I'm trying to improve only the Jewish economy. And the less that people interacted with each other, the easier it got to fall into a lot of the dehumanizing patterns, which means that what ends up happening in the emerging Zionist project there was that it recreated a lot of the most horrific dimensions of other forms of racist settler projects and different nationalistic projects that gradually dehumanize the other and push people out. It got more and more aggressive. So where we ended up by the time to get into like the 1930s and 40s, it makes sense because you've got people completely cut off from that the Palestinian neighbors. They no longer think of themselves as sharing a destiny with them, that they instead are people who don't belong here, that they're stopping me from doing what I want to do on my land. And there's this sense of like mine and not yours, rather than what can we build together. And over time, that just gets more and more extreme, especially when you add in religious dimensions to it. I mean, realistically, if any Israeli government were serious about dividing into two states and giving a Palestinian state in the West Bank, they would provoke a civil war inside Israel, because a significant chunk of that settler population and a lot of people inside 1948 Israel who share their views, they view any possible concession, any loss of that territory, as a repudiation of their own religious and cultural identity. And it's really worth understanding for people who don't know a lot of the long-term history. The biblical heartland is actually the West Bank. Most of the important Jewish archaeological sites are all in the West Bank, because
Abraham's tomb.
But like the southern kingdom of Judah, which is, you know, what gives its, you know, name and identity to what become the Jews, right? The southern kingdom of Judah is the southern part of the West Bank. And the northern kingdom of Israel was the northern part of the West Bank, and then a large part of the Galilee above that. So most of the two biblical states that we tend to associate with Judaism are where Palestinians are living. And even inside Israel's borders in the Galilee Valley, in the Galilee, a lot of Palestinian villages are still there. So that's where a lot of like the Israeli Arab population live. So the areas where Palestinians are most densely settled is actually where Judaism's roots are. But again, it just reinforces the fact that ultimately these were the same peoples. This is why there's so much genetic overlap between Jews, Samaritans, Lebanese, and Palestinians. They all ultimately come from exactly the same original populations. And some of them just stayed and some were chased out. You know, it looks along those lines.
I've always thought about how amazing it has been that the Palestinians have been able to preserve these sites throughout the centuries, not minding the fact that it's been conquered and taken over by different empires, but somehow the Palestinians were able to preserve these sites and guard it with their lives often. And I'm personally thankful for it as a Christian, because when my experience in the West Bank and me seeing these holy and sacred sites to me and others has been always through Palestinian guidance. They were always the one to show me these sacred sites and to curate them for me. And so in a sense, my walk as a Christian went hand in hand with that of Palestinians, because they were the ones that brought me to these sacred sites. So it's interesting to just see that, that the conflict in through the eyes of these biblical sites, as opposed to seeing it from our modern eyes, but rather seeing the conflict through the ancient, you know, viewpoint of it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, for sure. I mean, peoples tend not to leave lands. It's very unusual for lands to be completely depopulated and replaced by somebody else. Most of the time, the cultures just shift. And you can do this just anywhere you go in the world. You know, peoples are always thinking that they know the start of some particular, you know, country, some particular group of people. And you can just, you can always go back farther and farther and farther. And people want to think, oh, well, okay, so we get that, like the English, there's the Norman conquest, and before that, the Anglo-Saxon and Ute populations, and then before that, there were Celts, but it wasn't originally Celtic either. The Celts were also migrants, and their languages just took over and replaced the existing languages. There were Neolithic populations that were there thousands of years before Celtic languages even got to Europe. And therefore, there are people today in Britain who have DNA from Neolithic populations, even before the Celts. I mean, there's always these earlier layers, but the cultures themselves will change. The languages will change. The religions will change. So Palestinians, culturally, you can't just unambiguously say, well, they're Canaanite or they're Jewish or they're this or they're that, but there are certain elements that pass along. There are elements of Palestinian popular culture that actually derive from earlier forms of Judaism. There are elements of Palestinian culture that derive from earlier Canaanite elements, but there's also tons of things that come in later as well with later waves of influence, because all cultures are constantly evolving. They're constantly changing. So what a lot of people try to do is they delegitimize Palestinians by saying, oh, well, they speak Arabic, so they're Arabs, so they must have come from Arabia. Well, no, like 99% of Arabs in the world do not have any Arabian ancestry at all. They just don't. The word now refers to an entire large language family that all descend from a period of conquest in the same way that the Romance languages in Europe do. So people trying to argue that Moroccans and Syrians are the same people because Arabs are Arabs are basically saying that, you know, Portuguese and Sicilians are the same freaking people, which is just stupid.
Hey, that brings up an interesting topic I've heard. Can you talk on the influence that Aramaic had on Palestinian Arabic as opposed to other versions of Arabic?
Yeah, you can see that in the entire Eastern Arabic, the entire dialect continuum in Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan. There's a significant Aramaic substrate. This is, there's a lot of, and again, we have to distinguish between the modern standard language, which is essentially an artificial construct based on classical Arabic, but no one actually speaks it. No one speaks classical Arabic as a language anymore, just like we don't speak the Saxon
Shakespearean
anywhere. Technically, Shakespeare's writing in modern English, but
oh, really?
The words drop
I still can't understand it.
I mean, yeah, technically speaking, Shakespeare is writing in the same language that we use now. Yeah, but if you go back to Chaucer, Chaucer is writing in Middle English, which means it's much more heavily Germanic. And if you go back to the Old English, you know, the Old English is a completely Germanic language. In modern English, you know, both whether ours or of Shakespeare's day, a significant part of our vocabulary, largely a majority of it, is actually of Romance origin because of the heavy French influence. The Normans completely changed English. The core vocabulary is still German, you know, so and or this, that, you know, father,
right.
Basic words, you know, like those are all still Germanic. But you would really struggle to form any sentence in English today that doesn't use vocabulary that ultimately goes back from Latin, goes back to Latin.
Yeah.
So it's changed a lot, you know, over the millennia. And the same is true with all forms of Arabic. The Arabic of the Quran is literally just a scriptural, like a liturgical language. It's one that you're going to use in order to read these early texts. But the common spoken forms are just like the forms of vulgar Latin that show up everywhere else. People are adopting this language because it's a language of administration. It's a language of culture and religion. But there's a heavy influence in the language they spoke before. So Aramaic heavily marks both the Mesopotamian and Levantine forms, but in different dialects of it, different forms of the Aramaic languages. And you get the same thing with Egypt. Egyptian Arabic is heavily influenced by Coptic. The ones across the Maghreb are heavily influenced by the different Amazigh languages. I mean, there's a ton of places like this. All the different forms of Arabic all have significant elements, common words, expressions, you know, slang statements, pronunciation aspects, you know, shifts in vowel usage, you know, shifts in consonants even. You know, is this supposed to be a J sound or a G sound? Well, it depends on where you are. And that actually depends upon the pre-existing language, right? I mean, why do Egyptians say Gamal instead of Jamal, right?
Right.
It comes from Coptic. So they all have that. There's a ton of fun, like popular expressions you can find in just common Lebanese Arabic that are literally borrowed right out of Aramaic.
Yeah. So, I mean, going back to Zionism, we were talking about the slow evolution of it in pre-1800s or pre-1900s, entering the modern era. So we have different degrees of Zionism out there, obviously. I, for one, described myself as a level one evangelical Zionist before I actually went to Israel and experienced what the Palestinians were going through, in which case I was like, yeah, this is not what I signed up for. You know, my simple form of Zionism was, it's a safe place for Jewish people to live, you know, in harmony, have autonomy, have sovereignty. And then I learned that, this has a dark, dark side to it that I'm just like, yeah, guys, I gotta check out of this. It's just not, no. So there's that. And then you have far, far right extreme Zionism. And I want to go into the far right extreme Zionism. Like, how far right is it over there? And how dangerous are those versions? And how has other versions here in the United States also, you know, influenced the whole chain of events that's led to what the Palestinians are going through and the corruption that we've seen?
Yeah, it's tough in a way because you still have to draw a kind of continuum across different forms of nationalism in order to understand where, you know, how Israel gets to be what it is today. Because some of the worst aspects of it wouldn't technically be quote unquote far right. I mean, look at Ben Gurion and his Mapai party, right? Ben Gurion was economically a socialist and thought of himself as a leftist and led a literal socialist party. And yet he was a territorial maximalist who wanted to expel all the Palestinians and take 100% of Palestine. And at the time, that even included southern Lebanon and the western part of Jordan. I mean, there was a significant strain in even the left of this, but it's the left nationalist trend. Because Zionist leftists, what they meant by Zionism varied a lot. Some of them were literally communists who took quite seriously the injunction to also organize the Palestinians, bring them into the unions, you know, build some kind of shared future with them on the basis of class, you know, class conflict and struggle with the bosses and all the rest of that, and then build some common future together that would respect both Hebrew and Arabic speakers. So they were Zionists in the sense we should move there and pursue our, you know, our national aspirations in this land, but they were aiming for a Palestine that would be socialist and would include both populations. But the version that wins even on the left is an ethno-national version. And there's what that does is it creates a really interesting hybrid ideology that's both nationalistic but also still economically socialistic. the far right has its origins also in the teens and 20s, but dispenses with the socialist economics. That's the main thing that separates them. What becomes, you know, what emerges out of like the Betar movement and Jabotinsky's, you know, Hatzohar, which, you know, evolves into the Herut party, which evolves into the current Likud party. There's a steady change. It's really love to change political party names and remix things. But the there's a continuous progression and the same people involved. And that is what we could call an explicitly far right movement, but a secular far right. So they're not religiously, you know, Jewish in that sense, but they are ethnically Jewish hardcore nationalists. But they dispense with any of the socialist economic elements. So they're much more comfortable with, you know, elements of authoritarianism and with, you know, capitalism and all the rest of that.
How hardcore does it get? Like, what's the most extreme that you are aware of?
Yeah,
of how it gets? I've seen some extreme stuff, but I want to know how extreme it gets.
Well, yeah, that's tough. A lot of the earliest elements of the far right, paradoxically, while denying real autonomy or rights to that indigenous population, were in some ways nicer to them than the original left was, because Ben Gurion's faction was all for expelling all the Palestinians, and Jabotinsky's faction was more for, well, they can stay here, they just have to accept that we're in charge. You know, it's right. Like a very imperialistic kind of, like, you will be third class citizens at best when you accept that you will never have autonomy and that this is our country, then we'll give you some autonomy. But that's a little bit better than like chasing people out through massacres and expulsions and whatnot and seizing it entirely. But the over time, it gets to be to carry out a lot of the way you would imagine far right movements being, much more heavily racist, much more exclusivist, much more in favor of ethnic cleansings and expulsions. It gets to, by the time you get into, you know, the 60s and 70s, there are significant movements calling for an ethnic cleansing of the remaining Palestinians, you know, whether you're talking about in the territories or in 48 Israel. You end up with developments like the Kach movement that starts with Meir Kahan calling for, well, we'll try and pay them off to leave, but if that doesn't work, then we'll just chase them out however it happens. But yeah, calling for violent ethnic cleansing of the land entirely. And that gets worse, I think, when you add a bit of fundamentalist fervor to it. Because religion doesn't as easily brook compromise. It doesn't as easily tolerate difference. And when you add in that kind of, this is the only way and the only truth to an ethno-national movement, you end up with the current Zionist far right, which is, well, an element of it. Because again, some of it is secular. That'd be like Netanyahu's branch of it. They're secular far rightists. But the religious far rightists, what make up a significant part of the settler movement, what they have done is actually significant damage to the culture of Judaism as a whole by advancing the most batshit crazy interpretations of traditional texts. Now, for anybody who doesn't know, and I do see this sometimes circulated around, because again, there's a lot of unconscious and quite honestly accidental bits of anti-Semitism, even in the pro-Palestinian circles. And some of those I've seen arguments around Talmud, and they'll point to the bad aspects in Talmud, like the most horrifying statements in it. And they'll say, see, look, this says Jews bad. I'm like, nah, bro, it also has the exact opposite statements. Talmud is just a collection of arguments. They collected everything.
Right.
And over many years. So the same actual scholar, the same sage who might be saying, fuck all non-Jews, might a few pages later say, I love all Jews and welcome all the strangers. You know, it just depends on what mood they're in on a given day when they say something, but they tried to document and save every argument they could. Yeah, so in that way, it's a lot like collections of commentaries you have in tons of other religions. You know,
yeah.
Like, it's not like every single hadith agrees with one another. You know, it's not like every single school of Sharia all agrees. They don't. There's tons of diversity because they save everything, and there's room for debate on things like this. But some of these, this rabbi, sorry.
I just got a question about, so moving, going back to the Talmud, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Now, there are extreme things written in the Talmud, and there's also some very progressive things written in the Talmud that counteract each other. It is a collection of arguments, essentially, by rabbis.
Right.
Now, that said, are the extreme things that are written in the Talmud, have those played a role amongst this extremism, amongst these settler groups, amongst these extreme far-right religious ethno? Yeah, can you go into that, about the role that some of these things have played?
The key here is, and why I would say, why I would argue this is doing real damage to Judaism as a whole, is that while all the arguments are there, there are traditions that suggest this interpretation is better than this one, this argument is better than this one. I mean, that's ultimately the basis of a lot of traditional Jewish education is, you know, two people sitting across the desk from each other, both reading passages from a particular tractate and then arguing about them and practicing their own rhetoric, practicing their ability to convince people. And it just so happened that more often than not, certain arguments would win because the actual rationale in the text is better for them. The actual sources are better behind arguments like that. And the whole, I don't know, golden rule, do unto other kind of stuff. I mean, that's present in Judaism too, and it's a common perspective. So the passages that would say, you know, don't save the lives of non-Jews because they're inferior is not the kind of thing that most Jews would ever have taken seriously. They would have said, yeah, that's there as an example of a very bad argument.
Right. It's
here you can go back, oh, look to this passage here, Leviticus, that says, welcome strangers into your land as if they're your own, all this kind of crap here. There's no basis for that hatred of others. And one of the things that the ethno-national settlers really misunderstand is that the actual ancient states were themselves very diverse culturally and religiously. There were always multiple languages and religions present in the land, always. At no point did Jews ever control all of it. But what they're doing is they're pulling out some of the most vile and vicious statements in it that Jews have for almost two millennia said, that's an example of a terrible argument and what we should be able to shoot down in our practice for doing this kind of study. And you're saying it's the right one. You're saying that's what we should be doing. So you get people arguing, for example, there's a car accident outside your door, right outside your house. You know, two cars smash into each other, there's bodies spilled out onto the pavement, there's blood, and you want to rush out and help, but it's Shabbat and you're not allowed to do work on Shabbat. So the question that these religious Zionists would ask is, are the people who were injured Jews? If they are, you can set aside the no work thing and go out and help them. If they're not Jews, let them die.
Right.
And that's, what the fuck? Like, this is not something that we would have ever taken seriously before as an idea. Arguments like that really only gain credence because of the occupation and because of the dynamics, you know, because of the ethnocratic dimensions there, because they are growing up in a racist settler colony. You know, that shapes the way they'll interpret the texts. You've got people issuing rulings that say that Jews cannot take blood transfusions from non-Jews because non-Jews are literally a different species, which is just, what the fuck?
It's an extreme example of self-racism.
Yeah, and again, it directly contradicts Torah. It's the kind of thing that rabbis for millennia have said, this is a horrifying idea, no one should take this seriously, but they're pulling out and twisting these things in a way that suits not the religion itself, but the logic of a racist settler colony. In the same exact way that American Christians twisted their own texts and, you know, lost all those places where, you know, I don't know, like,
maybe love thy neighbor,
love everybody and take care of the sick and the injured and all this stuff. But they're like, oh no, man, there's the Hamitic race and they're black and we should keep them in slavery forever. And they just twist the Bible. I mean, there's literally nothing in the Bible that describes Ham and his descendants as black.
No, in fact, I've made the argument to the opposite, that Hamite translated means burnt skin, and that would more or less describe a white person going in the sun. So there's so I've made that argument that, you know, they're the claim that the justification for slavery against black people was back in the Deep South and before that was predicated on that verse about Noah's son, that because Noah's son Ham was the cursed son and he would be the servants of the world, and therefore it meant the black people, when in fact some people have argued that Hamites wound up becoming what would become the Europeans, white skin, because they get burnt.
Even then, though, this whole idea of them becoming different peoples is not biblical, and that etymology isn't original either. It's a matter of linguistic evolution, the way things change. It wouldn't originally have anything to do with like being burnt skin. That's because languages evolve over time, and therefore even when you look back and so you can say, oh, the text never changes, it's the scripture, it's the same words. Well, no, if your understanding those words shifts over time, they take on different qualities. So sometimes just pointing to what is the meaning of a phrase now doesn't help a lot. I mean, even very basic stuff like, okay, we say Moshe means from water. You know, so like Moses' name is plucked from the river. It means from water. Well, yeah, that's a later etymology given to it. The actual origin of the word is literally Egyptian. It's not even Hebrew. There was no analog for this originally when a meaning was developed that fit that context, and now it's the meaning of the word. So it just, there's always shifts like that. But what they did was they went to something that had never existed before, and in order to justify the Atlantic slave trade, they had to come up with ways to drive this biblically. And what they created was a deeply racist form of Christianity that is still a fundamental part of American evangelicalism. I mean, it's really hard to separate racism from evangelical Christianity in the U.S. And that is a damn shame, but it's because it got baked in at its origins, you know, in a particular form of Protestantism that develops here.
Yeah.
And there's something very similar happening right now in Israel because of the logic of their own ethnocratic state. So if you're going to start interpreting your own texts, your context affects the way you read them. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you were reading these, you know, in a totally different country, in a different century, whatever, that stuff would never occur to you. But yeah, some of it gets, as you say, really extreme and pretty damn racist. Hey, nobody wants to see this.
Now, we're talking about the far right extreme versions of Zionism and how you have, you know, that extreme scale over to the settlers, which we see, but also that extremism, in my opinion, from my experience being over there, was it filters down to the spectrum of extremism into the general culture that may be secular. And I saw this, for example, I went to this Kabbalah center that was across the street from the Hebrew University dormitory. And there was I think he's a well-known rabbi. And I walked in, this is back when I was like what I call a brochure level one Zionist, walked in with some American Jews to get like a little Torah study. And it was interesting when he read a verse, and I cannot remember what the verse was, and the translation of that verse came to the final lesson that really came out to being a very extreme form of paranoia. His interpretation was, see, this is why you cannot trust the Goy. This is why you cannot trust a non-Jew, because even the kind ones, even the ones that appear to be friends, they are eventually going to be your enemy. And I was looking at that, and mind you, he didn't know that I wasn't Jewish. And I was like, this, it deeply troubled me, because I'm like, these young Jewish kids who have the whole world in front of them are being fed this paranoid ideology that now, luckily, a lot of them were kind of in the same boat as me. They're looking at each other like, this guy's nuts. And, you know, but at the same time, I'm thinking, okay, we may have thought it was nuts, me and these other American Jews, me being the only non-Jew in the crowd, we were all thinking the same thing. However, that's just one little sliver of what we experience as Americans. You look at what young Jewish folks growing up in Israel are mm-hmm. surrounded by. This form of Zionism has ingrained deep paranoia, and we're seeing the culmination of that, the climax of that, and this sheer genocidal rhetoric towards Palestinians yeah. that we're seeing as a result of the genocide in Gaza. So the paranoia is kind of what I want to touch on too, that has resulted from this, from Zionism. Paranoia,
I think, is actually a way of processing some of the disasters of the last century.
Yes.
And realistically, there's been quite a significant transformation over long periods of time in the whole concept of goy. Because it doesn't originally have the meaning that we give it at all in the Bible. It yeah. literally does not mean that. But it's taken on a lot of different baggage. And some of that has been affected by not only the development of nationalism, but also the many disasters that Jews have faced that caused them to struggle to trust other peoples. And honestly, some of that distrust is more than justified. I mean, the Christian world has been genuinely horrifying to Jews for about two millennia. And yep. I don't see that changing anytime soon, because there are some pretty deep theological and cultural roots to it. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, it's very easy to point to outsiders as something that you can't trust. Now, it's unfortunate because, again, it's obviously not true. We always have to deal with people yeah. on an individual level, deal with particular ideologies. So if somebody has a harmful ideology, yeah, I'm not going to trust far rightists. But right. that doesn't mean I'm going to distrust other Californians by default. You know, it doesn't make yeah. sense. But it's at least an understandable development culturally. Zionism makes it worse specifically because of the way it folds the Palestinians into it. Because yep. Palestinians were not historically the problem here. That prejudice was a function of the Christian world and originally of states under canon law. And for a long, long time, the Middle East was not ruled according to Christian canon law. So those Christian interpretations faded away. They weren't relevant in the area anymore. They might have been in the 4th century, 5th century, and there was a whole lot of anti-Judaism on the land in Palestine. But not by the time you get to the 15th. It's just not part of their lived reality. Because one big difference between Islam and the two previous Abrahamic faiths is that it explicitly acknowledges that both of the two older ones have a legitimate revelation from God, and therefore they're not infidels, so they can't be, kicked around. Where Jews thought that Christians were just insane Jews who headed off in the wrong direction, and
right.
Christians looked at Jews as people who just rejected God and killed God, and like there's so the and then they both later looked at Muslims like, who the fuck are you, bro? Like, Christians for a long time referred to Muslims as Mohammedans. They thought that they worship Muhammad the way that Christians worship Jesus, yeah. Which is a complete misunderstanding. Yeah. But it changes the dimensions of it. So the kind of anti-Semitism that would be normal in areas of Christian majority just weren't anymore in Palestine. And because of the settler colonial project and the gradual seizure of land, unfortunately, a lot of Palestinians began adopting some of those European anti-Semitic tropes, because their enemies were clearly Jews, and here are these other Europeans talking about Jews bad. Oh, okay, so that some of that stuff can fall to them. But it's a very recent development. But the more that anybody has done that, everybody who's fallen into that trap, whether in Palestine or in the diaspora, has actually fed into a kind of generational paranoia, a kind of generational trauma that says that people will always look at us as some kind of alien, untrustworthy people and attack us, and therefore we have to be cautious about them and look out for our own. And on some level, there is at least an element of that that has contributed to the survival of Judaism over a long period of time. It's very difficult for ethnic groups to survive completely in exile, you know, in a massive global diaspora spread all around the world. Judaism is a really unusual case study in the world in having done so. So some elements of that distrust were beneficial to the survival of Judaism, but put into a situation like an ethnocratic settler colony, and it brings out the absolute worst interpretations of that, which then causes you to distrust everybody who's different from you and to lash out and attack everyone who's different from you.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really kind of sad. There's a lot of really good research. In fact, I've got an entire book on the evolution of the concept of the goy, the goyim, the Jewish views of the other, you know, over time. And it's amazing the way that these traditional views are so fundamentally different from the kind of shit that you will hear from preachers today in parts of Israel.
Yeah, I agree. I want to take a quick restroom break. We're at the hour mark, and we're going to get into anti-Semitism, if that's okay.
No, that sounds good.
All right, be right back.
Actually, while you're doing that, I think I'm going to refresh this a little bit.
Oh, I thought you were going to hand it across the screen to me, and I was going to refill it up. I literally
want to give me a drink. No, but I'm going to go.
Yeah.
All right.